We're very fortunate indeed to have Rabbi J. David Bleich in Long Beach to answer many of our halakhic questions concerning primarily medical practice and related topics. Dr. Bleich is one of the world's leading authorities on this topic. He is the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, has written extensively. We're all familiar with his book on Judaism and Healing, which recently came out. He has published numerous articles in Noyam and in Tradition. He has been a fellow of the Hastings Center for Ethics, Society, and the Life Sciences, as well as a lecturer at the Yeshiva University Medical School, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Bleich. The format that we have used was to have written questions in advance, as we announced, and what we hope to do is if we can finish with the written questions, then we will open up the session to questions from the audience, which we would hope would be related to this topic. We did have an introductory get acquainted session with Rabbi Bleich and the doctors, who asked some very nitty-gritty medical questions that might not pertain to a general audience. So some of the questions that you see on the sheets have already been answered and are available on tape. Basically, we already talked about the doctor's behavior on Shabbos, and we've also answered some of the general questions and the questions about obstetrics and gynecology. I think we left one of the general questions, which is a good opener for a general audience for today, and I think that would be appropriate to start off with. Somebody has asked, am I allowed to smoke cigarettes?
Shall I begin? Really? All right.
Nice threatening question to begin with.
Is that a rabbinic question or a
question? Sounds like a medical question. Let me try to explain in brief and in general. There's one very brief tshuva in Igros Moshe dealing with smoking cigarettes. It's, I think, 6.5 lines long, and it reads, for those of you who are familiar with the Tzofas Paneach or the Rakachover, he wrote tshuvas in a half a line and then filled up the rest of the page saying, ayin, 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 or look here, there, and the other place. That's how this tshuva Igros Moshe reads. It says, essentially, Shomer Psoim Hashem, and then the ayins, look, is the source of every place in Shas, where there's a concept of Shomer Psoim Hashem. Let me explain what the concept of Shomer Psoim Hashem means. The Shomer Psoim Hashem is a posuk in Tehillim. It's quoted in the Gemara in a variety of contexts. What it means is that the Rabbanu Shel Olam preserves the simple. Simple in the sense of people who aren't terribly intelligent and aren't terribly smart. So let me say first and foremost, it's very foolish to smoke cigarettes. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily osur. Now, in terms of what's mutter and what is osur, there is absolutely nothing in life which isn't dangerous. Life is an extremely dangerous occupation. It's a terminal disease. You die of life. And there's absolutely nothing that you do or do not do that doesn't hasten the process. That doesn't mean that everything is necessarily osur. By the same token, it's osur for a person to place himself in mokum sakon. The person has no right to place himself in a situation in which there is a perceived or a perceivable danger. Now, the problem then is to define as clearly as possible those areas of activity which are permissible even though they involve danger, and those areas of activity which are forbidden precisely because they involve danger. And there are a number of discussions in Achronim of the concept of Shemar Psoim Hashem, even earlier than the discussions concerning smoking. The best example, I think, of analysis of Shemar Psoim in order to put it into a kind of a framework that one can grapple with is the Sugi of Gimel Noshim, contraception of the Gemara. Contraception where some birth control activity that would otherwise be usur is permissible for reasons of pikuach nefesh. And it turns out that in the Gemara there's a machloikis with regard to the machloikis tanoim, it's a brisa. It's a machloikis with regard to whether the moich can be used, a certain type of contraceptive. Reb Meir says it's permissible, and the Chachomim say either it's not permissible or it's not mandatory. Again, you have machloikis rashi and tosfos. That was last night's topic in any event. We're not interested in talking about birth control per se, but the Chachomim say that a woman doesn't have to or is not permitted to use certain birth control devices. Heaven will have mercy. And obviously, this is problematic. Well, what do you mean? It's pikuach nefesh. The woman's life will be endangered if she takes no precautions. And here the Chachomim, at the very minimum, are saying that she's not obligated to engage in birth control methods in order to prevent pregnancy. And the Gemara states, Shemer psoim Hashem. Now, the concept of Shemar Psoim Hashem at the very minimum, I'll try in a moment to try to explain it in a different way. At the very minimum, Shemar Psoim Hashem means that if society in general does not perceive something to be dangerous, then you can engage in that activity with impunity, even though, Klapi Shmaya Galia, heaven knows it is dangerous. Everything is dangerous. What this means then is that Chazal did not give us a statistical criterion of danger. They didn't say that if something has a 20% mortality rate, it's also, or a 2% mortality rate, it's also. What they said was that if people perceive it as being dangerous, then it's a forbidden activity. If people are oblivious, and ignorance is sometimes bliss, if they're blissfully unaware of the danger, then this isn't an activity which is also. It may be a very foolish type of thing to engage in, but Shemar Psoim Hashem, Rabbeinu Shlomo, will take care of the fools. If they want to be foolish, they have the right to be foolish. Which means then that, for example, I don't know what the statistics are for airplane accidents. I'm told that per passenger mile there are more automobile accidents than airplane fatalities. I'm not entirely certain that if we were living in the time of Chazal, they would not have forbidden automobile travel. If they asked Mayi Megulim, uncovered water, because maybe a snake will come along and spit some venom into it, you may drink it, a rather far-fetched kind of shash, but Chazal were worried about it. If they were worried about that, it seems to me they might have been worried about automobile travel. But there were no horseless carriages in those days, and Chazal didn't asser it, so there's no Isid Rabbonah. There's no rabbinic prohibition. In terms of biblical prohibitions, it's clear that people who get into the automobile don't stop to consult the atlas to find out what the statistics are for automobile fatalities. They assume that nothing is going to happen. You know, let's take it for granted. Automobile travel is safe, whatever that may mean. By the same token, these gliders I saw for the first time, I read about them, but on the West Coast I saw somebody gliding. I don't know what the statistics are for gliding fatalities. It won't take terribly much to convince me that it's safer than driving an automobile per passenger mile. But if someone were to ask me, are you allowed to take a glider ride, I think I would probably answer that it's also l'odom lamid v'mokim sakone. Riding in a glider is a sakone. I think society perceives it as a sakone. At least on the East Coast, we perceive it as a sakone. And that's an example of something which is forbidden because of sakone, even though riding in an automobile, which may very well be statistically more dangerous, is permissible. Why? Because this is doshe b'rabim, is loshen the Gemara. People have trodden upon it. It's already a a well-trodden path. Everybody accepts it as being non-dangerous. Therefore, you have a right to play the fool and say, Shem Ripsoy Mashem, whereas if you're engaged in an activity which people do not perceive as being free from danger, you have no right to place yourself in that type of sakonet. Now, applying this to cigarette smoking, I don't know what the answer is. Certainly 15 years ago, people did not assume that there was any terribly significant danger associated with smoking cigarettes. Every doctor knows how bad it is. It's dangerous. It really is dangerous. Whether people accept that risk and sort of assume that there is no risk or try to lull themselves into complacency, I think we're going through a transitional period. I think that 10 or 20 years from now, everybody will know how dangerous it is, and it will be like the glider. I don't think that the argument Shem Ripsoyim Hashem will apply someplace down the road. Here and now, I think that it still applies, or better, I can quote the Igros Moshe. Rav Moshe wrote the tshuva and published it, and hasn't withdrawn it. In fact, he's reaffirmed it very recently in another tshuva dealing with smoking in the base medrash. And it's generally assumed that this isn't a terribly dangerous activity, and therefore you can rely on the principle Shem Ripsoy Mashem. Now, I need a kind of an insurance policy, because 20 years from now I suspect that this isn't going to work, because by then everybody will realize how dangerous it is. The insurance policy is the second argument, the argument based upon the sugi of Gimel Noshim, this contraception. And it's best formulated, I think, by Rabbi Yankiv Ettlinger in the Binyan Si, and there's a shuv in the Binyan Si, and he asks the question everybody asks. And in effect says that even assuming that the birth control device would be usur, then it may be very difficult, but the halacha should be that the couple are obligated to be divorced. Who is matir something of this nature simply because of a sakona? And if there is a real sakona, and divorce isn't an option for whatever reason, then everybody should mandate use of a contraceptive device if pregnancy will lead to a danger to the life of the mother. And he then proceeds to formulate a rule with regard to pikuach nefesh. And he does this by asking another kasha. Everybody's familiar with Birkas HaGoyma. People make a bracha. HaGoyma l'chayovim tevesh, HaGoyma l'ani kol tev. Once upon a time, when there was a Beis HaMikdosh, the Abot Tzrichim Lohedos, the people who have to make a Birkas HaGoyma, had to bring a korban toita. They had to bring a Thanksgiving offering. You had to bring a sacrifice in Thanksgiving for having been released from a situation that was fraught with danger. Now, in halacha, there are four categories. Two are uncontrollable. The people, one of them is somebody who has been sick with a deathly illness and has recovered. Another one is somebody who's been imprisoned and who is in danger of execution. Presumably, those you can't control. But there are two other categories. One is Yordei Hayom, people who go on sea voyages, and the others are Yetzei Bishayor, people who go in the desert on caravan journeys. There's no place in Shulchan Aruch that says you're not allowed to go on a caravan journey, even for pleasure, let alone for business. And even if you're going for business, who says you're allowed to take your life in your hands to earn an extra dollar? What business do these people have traveling through deserts in the first place? And it was clearly dangerous. Otherwise, there wouldn't be an obligation for a korban toida, a Thanksgiving offering, and a bracha, thanking the Rabbanu Shalom for saving you from a sakona. What right do you have to place yourself in sakona in general? Says the Binyan Siyan, there are two types of sakon. You've got to distinguish between two distinct categories. If you walk under the Leaning Tower of Pisa and it's shaking, it's about to fall down, that's usur. Even though statistically the chances that it will fall down are rather remote. Why? Because there you're dealing with a danger which is present here and now. You are b'mokim sakona, you're in a place of danger. You have no right to place yourself in danger, evil Knievel style, and tell the Rabbanu Shalom, it's your job, you take care of me, I don't have to worry about it. But there are other kinds of danger which you can assume. The person is going on a sea journey or a caravan voyage. When he gets on the camel's back, there's no danger. He's got plenty of water, and the sun isn't burning too hard. There's no danger of sunstroke. The person who's going on the sea voyage is going to a seaworthy vessel. There's no problem.
The problem will arise someplace in the course of the journey. If there'll be a storm at sea, the ship can capsize. You can get lost in the wilderness. You're dealing not with a present danger, but with a future danger. When you're dealing with a future danger, says the Binyan, then the ordinary categories of roiv and miyuv, majority and minority, apply. In Pikuach Nefesh, there's a principle that you ignore questions of majority and minority. You have to be Machal Shabbos. Virtually all prohibitions are suspended in order to preserve a life, even if there is merely a remote possibility of danger, but that's only when the danger is present here and now. When you're dealing with an identifiable danger that you can put your finger on. When you're dealing with a future danger, which is statistical in nature, says the Binyan Tzion, there the general principle of Rav applies. If in the majority of cases this activity isn't dangerous, you don't have to worry about a danger someplace down the road. The person going on the voyage doesn't have to worry about a danger which will arise sometime in the course of the trip, because in the majority of cases nothing is going to happen. And he applies this to the sugya of Gimel Noshim and says that's dealing with a certain restricted type of medical condition. A medical condition which isn't going to have very bad ramifications in the majority of cases. It's only a small minority of women who will be endangered thereby. Therefore, the woman has the right to engage in cohabitation, because A, who says she'll become pregnant, and B, if she does become pregnant, who says that this is going to lead to a danger, etc., etc. Now, if you take that and apply it to smoking, it seems to me that there's a second reason to permit smoking, although again, it doesn't mean it's very wise to smoke. What it means then is that if the majority of smokers do not have their lives foreshortened as a result of cigarette smoking, and I say if because it's a big if, I don't know. The medical literature may in the very short future reflect that 51% of all smokers do have their lives foreshortened if you add the statistics of people dying of lung cancer and heart disease associated with cigarette smoking, emphysema and hypertension, what have you. If you add them all together, once the studies are complete, then it may turn out that 50% of smokers do die as a result of smoking. But
to be dying or just hurting themselves?
I'm not sure about hurting themselves. But let's talk about mortality. What about morbidity afterwards? In terms of mortality, at present, I don't think that there's enough evidence to conclude that the majority of all smokers die as a result of smoking. Hence, we're dealing with a danger which isn't here and now. The cigarette that you take in your hand isn't going to kill you. Cumulatively, it may result in contracting something or other that may either kill you or lead to certain complications that will foreshorten life. But it seems to me that the Binyan Tzion's argument applies to cigarette smoking, at least in the present. So, you know, just to summarize, it seems to me that it's very, very foolish to smoke. B, I could not say that it's osir to smoke right now, but if you ask me 5 years from now, then I might have to say that it's osir. But I would add one caveat, and going out on a limb, Lanias Daitin, on my humble opinion, it's absolutely osir to smoke on Yontif. On Yontif, I'll explain. There are a number of Achrenim have forbidden smoking on Yontif. Because while certain things are permissible on Yontif, including smoking and burning and what have you, but it's not burning something for no purpose. It's mutter basically for Echel Nefesh, anything which is associated with cooking, or some other pleasure which is derived from the malacha that is being performed. However, not every pleasure is permissible on Yontif. The Gemara says clearly it has to be something which is a dover hashove l'chol nefesh, a pleasure that everybody shares in. If it's some kind of far out pleasure that only some people enjoy, like the burning of incense, one example, if it's something that only some kooks or whatever enjoy, then this isn't permissible on Yontif, even for people who do enjoy it. As a result, when cigarettes first came on the market, what was it, in the 18th century, there were a number of Achrenim who said that you're not allowed to smoke on Yontif because it's not a dover show of vocal nefesh. Women didn't smoke, first of all, and not every male smoked. Therefore, only a minority of people who smoked, so on Yontif is not permissible. The matirim, the korban asadol, acid smoking. The matirim, among them was the Pnei Yeshua. That's the grandfather of the Pnei Yeshua, the commentary on the Gemara. But the tshuvas of the Pnei Yeshua, who is the grandfather of the Mefarish, he's matir smoking, as are a number of other achronim, on the basis of a very interesting argument. They argued that people, at least some people, smoke for health reasons. La'akel hamozein, it aids in digestion. And he said, since it's a therapeutic measure, therapy on yontif is mutter. That's a dover shov l'chol nefesh. You may not be sick today, but everybody gets sick sometime or another, and therefore a therapy is by definition a dover shov l'chol nefesh, because everybody needs it when they're sick. Therefore, these achrenim permitted smoking on yontif because they viewed it as being therapeutic. It was a health measure. In fact, the Pnei Yeshua says that if you're one of these machmirim who don't smoke on yontif, be careful not to be makabel as a nether. Don't make a nether out of it, because you might need it sometime. A doctor might prescribe it, and therefore you want to have at least the option. Now, clearly, if that is the only reason to be matir smoking on yontif, if the facts are not correct and are perceived not to be correct anymore, then we're dealing with something which is no longer dover hashav l'chol nefesh. Most people are not fools. They don't smoke, thank heavens. It's only a minority of people who smoke, and therefore it's forbidden even to that minority on yontif. I do not see any heter for smoking on yontif.
Smoke
the rest of the time.
Period.
Since only a minority of people smoke, period, hence smoking is an activity which is not a dover hashover l'chol nefesh. It's not a benefit or a pleasure which all people share. Since not everyone shares the pleasure, therefore it's forbidden to everybody on Yom Kippur. Oh yes, definitely. Yes, yes.
Can we?
We have some hands raised, shall we?
Yeah, this is Berkowitz.
If smoking is dangerous to your health, and the person who feels like smoking wants to take that risk, do they have a right to take that risk in a room where there are people who
object?
Who object?
Whose room is it? In a public room, where the person who is offended thereby has equal rights to be present.
Right.
All right, look, that's it's in the category of hachokas nezikin. I'm not acquainted with the literature, or put it this way, I haven't been persuaded by what I've read. But if it is indeed the case that people are significantly affected by smoke, the passive smokers, the people who inhale smoke that's been exhaled by somebody else, if that causes danger to health, then it's certainly usur to smoke where there are other people who object to it. If they waive their objection, everything is permissible. If they don't mind, then there's no reason.
You have to voice your objection.
No, you don't have to voice the objection. As long as it's something to which reasonable people would object to, you wouldn't have to voice the objection. That would be presumed. Now, again, I'm not familiar enough with the studies. The studies that I've read have all involved people like bartenders who spend 8 or 10 hours a day in a heavily laden smoke-filled room, or Japanese women who spend hours in close, cramped quarters with husbands who smoke in their noses. I don't know if the same dangers exist in rather spacious, commodious places where you get a whiff of smoke or so, but you don't have a heavy concentration of smoke. I don't know the facts. If there is significant reason to suspect that it may be dangerous to the health of people who happen to be present, then without their express approval, it would be forbidden.
Since we're interested in bottom line answers, are there any doctors who could comment about the medical facts being raised?
Just one thing about that. You made a conclusion on the concept of the majority. 51% of the people have some proof. Where is that number? What is the derivation of that? And it seems to me that the probability of an event occurring might be 20%. That should be perhaps significant also.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than 51% of the proof.
I think the 20% is very significant. But in terms of mutter and osir, according to the Binyan Tzion, if you're dealing with an activity that might be dangerous here and now, that even if the danger is remote, it's osir. If you're dealing with an activity which pardon me, which right now is totally innocuous, it presents no immediate danger, but it may somehow in the future lead to a danger, then you're dealing with an ordinary situation in which the principle of majority applies. Now, halacha is filled with areas in which you apply the principle of majority as distinct from minority. You know, you assume that any given act belongs to the class of the major as distinct from the class of the minor. And hence, you assume that this act is not a dangerous act, or it's not an act that will lead to danger, since the majority of such acts do not precipitate dangers.
Not the one.
How come in a situation like where there's a question of pikuach nefesh, we go to tremendous extremes, even when there's a perceived danger sometimes, to avoid those activities? We eat gefilte fish with a different fork than we eat our chicken with, because of a perceived danger that maybe it would be bad for your health if there was a slight contamination of the meat with a fish fork, so it's become a minhag Yisrael. Yet here we have a situation where there's a 40% of all cancers caused by cigarette smoking, and it not unequivocally causes a high fraction of heart disease and hypertension and all kinds of other problems. And yet we say
that there were certain acts or broad categories of activity that Chazal forbade because of the danger, which means that minus or absent the rabbinic injunction, rabbinic legislation actually forbidding it, it would be a permitted activity. Once it has been forbidden, then it's in general category of any other Yisur Rabbana. I'm convinced that if Chazal were living today, they'd forbid smoking. There's no question in my mind they would forbid smoking. But we don't have a takona forbidding smoking. And absent the takona, then you've got to look at the general criteria of halacha and see whether they apply or not.
Since you raised the...
On the same grounds that the smoker is allowed to smoke. If it's not a danger here and now, or if it's a shemer psoim mashem, then you can inhale the other fellow's smoke the same way that he can smoke. You cannot engage in an activity that will be dangerous to another person, even if the danger is remote. It's one thing to do it for yourself, and quite another thing to expose somebody else to that kind of danger.
Rabbi
Engel? It seems to me that Binyan Tzion's argument isn't the same as smoking. Because when you're going in the desert, when you're setting out, it's a safe activity. The problem is that in a month down the line, you're afraid it'll become a major problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to assume, and according to how you say halakha will be in 20 years,
mm-hmm.
that, in other words, what the medical evidence is saying is that smoking today, the minute you're smoking, it causes a danger later. That's how I understand it.
As I understand it, there are many people who can smoke two packs of cigarettes a day for 15, 60 years and absolutely nothing happens to them. There are other people who begin smoking... I'm sorry? It's a minority. There are other people who begin smoking as teenagers, and while there may be subclinical physiological changes that take place immediately, but they certainly don't contract lung cancer immediately, they don't contract emphysema immediately, and what have you. Under those circumstances, the teenager who is smoking without ill effect right now, and without doing anything to his body that you can put a finger on and say, look what's happening, under those circumstances, he's smoking a time bomb. It'll explode 50 years later, maybe. And then you're dealing with majority-minority. I probably should add that a patient who's got emphysema, it seems to me, has no right to smoke. Now, at that point, you know what every cigarette is doing to the body. You know, at that point, you're not dealing with a future danger, but with actual damage to lung tissue, which occurs every time he inhales a cigarette, which is quite different from a person who is healthy, robust.
That may not be. No. Perfectly healthy person and inhales a cigarette is destroying a certain percentage of his lung cell.
Yes, every time I do that, I destroy capillaries too, with no ill effect.
But that's not a fair
Sure it is. If I can destroy lung cells without them affecting my health and certainly without affecting my life, then I don't necessarily have an issue to destroy those lung cells. You do destroy lung cells all the time. You destroy cells in the body constantly. That's part of normal life. You destroy them in smoking, and you destroy them other ways. The only problem is when you destroy them in a way that's going to affect mortality, then it becomes a problem. Unless and until it affects mortality, there's no problem. Just as one of the questions on the list, if I remember, had to do with blood transfusions. But, for example, destroying blood, forget about the iser of chavola, the iser of wounding oneself. The dissipation of blood cells in and of itself isn't usur in halacha. They're easily replenishable. You've got more than you need anyway. In fact, it may even be therapeutic. Bloodletting was regarded as therapeutic once upon a time, and now we've come full cycle, and it's now, at least in some circles, a form of treatment of hypertension. But it's the destruction or the dissipation of certain cells of the body in and of itself isn't necessarily usur, unless it's usur for some other reason, either because of a prohibition against wounding or because it will somehow have an effect upon longevity anticipation.
Okay. Mrs. Lovish.
You comment on, in line with this, the problem of alcoholism and overweight children, in line with long-term, short-term damage to your body.
Mm-hmm. We have a whole series of questions about that, including eating meat, and so forth and so on.
There isn't terribly much difference between smoking cigarettes and eating strawberry shortcake if you are 25% overweight. Eating strawberry shortcake if you're 25% overweight is likely to kill you a lot sooner than smoking cigarettes is likely to kill the otherwise normal and healthy individual. Again, the same general principles apply. Most people recognize in some vague way that body weight is associated with longevity, but nobody thinks that strawberry shortcake or Kugel or what have you is particularly dangerous to life. You've got the concept of Shem Ripsoyim Hashem, as well as the other concept of dealing with something which here and now is perfectly innocuous, but it may lead to something down the line. If the person is a diabetic, for example, and is about to eat a couple of sugar cubes or sugar in some other form, which he knows very well is going to cause the blood sugar to rise, I think you're dealing with something entirely different. A patient who is a diabetic, and by definition, diabetes is a chela sheyesh b'sakana, it's dangerous. The individual who increases the risk by purposely elevating high blood sugar, I think, is not acting according to halacha.
What about if he has a family history of diabetes?
Again, even with a family history of diabetes, all that this means is the likelihood of contracting diabetes is higher. But A, it's not immediate. And B, even with a family history, I'm not sure there's a 50% or higher chance that he will contract diabetes. So we're back to the two arguments with regard to smoking.
Uh-huh. Can I ask something which may be a little bit nitty-gritty, but you raised it today and actually discussed it in more detail yesterday, and that was you applied the concept of Shem Epesayim Hashem in the case of the pregnant women. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, I'm not that familiar with the case, but as I understood your analysis, you were saying that the women could become pregnant because it's a normal act of society that people accept, a normal risk. Mm-hmm. Yet yesterday you seemed to imply that the reason one could take contraceptive pills was that the risk of the pregnancy was greater than the risk.
Yesterday we were talking bottom lines. Today we were more theoretical. The sugya of Gimel Noshim, the locus classicus in the Gemara of contraception, is a very difficult sugya and has been understood different ways by different achronim. But beginning probably with the Tzemach Tzedek or the Chen Deshleim, I don't know who was earlier. I think they were roughly about the same time. And the Chayodom, as well as more recently by the Achiezer, all relatively recent day achronim,
understood that the machlekes in the Gemara, this agreement with regard to whether it is proper or mandatory for women, for these women described by the Gemara to use contraceptive measures, is limited to a situation in which there is a very remote likelihood of danger. And all you have to do is examine the three cases. The three cases involve a woman who is between the ages of 11 and 12, a nursing woman, and a woman who is already pregnant. The danger in the latter two cases is to the unborn fetus or to the nursing baby who may refuse to nurse and reject other forms of food. In the first case, the women of that tender age were viewed as being subject to certain dangers in becoming pregnant. But in each one of those cases, you're dealing with a danger which is rather remote. You know, contemporary experience certainly bears it out. Very few nursing women who become pregnant to subject their babies to danger. And very few pregnant women have a second pregnancy superimposed upon the first one. You're dealing with something which is extremely remote, extremely unlikely. Therefore, all these later Achronim say that the Gemara, the concept of Shem Psoim Hashem, you can rely on the Ribbono Shel Olam, applies only to these remote cases, whereas if you're dealing with a woman who's got got a renal problem, and the pregnancy is almost certainly going to kill her, or she's got breast cancer, and didn't our oncologist tell us yesterday that pregnancy is extremely dangerous for a woman who's got cancer of the breast? Under those circumstances, the Achronim would say that when you're dealing with a danger which is much more significant than the statistical chance of the mother not surviving the pregnancy or higher, there's no disagreement. Everybody would agree that it's a danger you have no right to assume. Under those circumstances, birth control measures would be mandatory. So that all contemporary authorities agree that a woman whose life is at risk in pregnancy has no right to become pregnant in the first place, and would say that the Gemara is talking about cases where the risks of pregnancy are very remote, but nevertheless there is a risk, not a significant risk.
I might add that you mentioned Tzemach Tzedek. Rabbi Levitansky was discussing the reason that his father-in-law, Rabbi Handel, the Lubavitch Rav of Montreal, is Rabbi Levitansky's father-in-law. Levitansky was explaining it to me, the reason that they, this came up yesterday about the use of a mic in a woman who, a diaphragm, a woman who was not in danger of losing life, just in danger of harming her health. Apparently he, as I understand it, the Tzemach Tzedek was mekel on this point.
In cases when there was danger to health. Danger to life, I'm sorry.
This is what...
When it was danger to life, not danger to health. Although, no, the distinction is not all that clear-cut. But the Achronim who permit the use of a diaphragm do so only when there is danger to the life of the mother.
Okay, Rabbi Newman.
Can I just take us back one step?
Yeah.
The Benyamin again, and the difference between the three categories.
Could you speak a little louder, please?
A louder also?
Yeah.
And the difference between the two categories.
There's a background noise.
With the wall that is, the leaning wall that is about to fall, the sakana. Sakana is an immediate sakana.
Yeah.
And it's going to immediately result in a loss of life.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Whereas all the other things that have been mentioned are over a period of time. As even smoking, that puff is not going to
kill you.
Right.
It's cumulative.
It's cumulative, right? Is there any distinction between that? I mean,
that's precisely the Benyamin's distinction.
But even in a case when it is a danger,
mm-hmm.
As even in, when someone is suffering from emphysema, whatever
right.
It is,
right.
Even then, that smoke is not going to be similar to, say, a leaning wall is going to fall.
A patient who's already suffering from emphysema, that you have to ask a doctor. My impression is that when you have a patient who is suffering from emphysema, you can almost literally measure the cost in minutes of life for every cigarette smoked.
That's my impression. Correct me if I'm wrong. My impression is if you've got a patient who is suffering from emphysema, or for that matter, cancer of the lung, if both lungs have been affected, you can literally, or almost literally, measure the cost of every cigarette in terms of minutes of life lost. If the patient is already got emphysema, and you've got, you know that the cigarette smoke is affecting the lung, you know that the X percent of the lung is already gone, and that the cigarette smoke is going to affect the other cells of the lung. Right or wrong?
I think the only way you can quantitate the effect of cigarettes is by measuring pulmonary function. I don't think there have been any studies to date measuring the number of lung cells, alveoli, or pulmonary cells that are lost as a result of cigarette smoke. But you can quantitate the pulmonary function by measuring, for example, how much air is inhaled or exhaled in X number of seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no question that if you take 100 normal people and you subject them to 1 month of cigarette smoking, that their pulmonary function, their 1 second test, will be decreased.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how many of these people can have reversible changes? You see, and that is really the gray area.
Well, it's not only the reversible change, but, for example, if you remove one lung or collapse a lung, you will decrease pulmonary function by 50%. Yet a person will enjoy normal longevity anticipation with one lung, as opposed to two lungs. In effect, you've got more than enough lung capacity, more than enough pulmonary capacity.
Reserved.
Yeah, see, so that's an insurance policy. very very good one. Baruch Hashem that the nature operates that way.
Yeah,
he did it purposely, of course. I'm not sure he did so he could smoke, but he did it for other reasons, very good reasons. Again, in terms of emphysema, I don't know. If a doctor is willing to say that an emphysema patient could smoke without endangering his life, then fine, I won't object. I suspect, however, that a pulmonary specialist would tell you that the patient who has emphysema and smokes is committing suicide.
But on the other hand, a gynecologist will tell you, they're running out of the room, a gynecologist will tell you that the incidence of premature births
is
increased tremendously by a woman who smokes.
Right.
So she may be facing a different kind of danger, or the unborn child is facing a different kind of danger. But I don't think that one cigarette, I'm not advocating that this patient smokes, but the one cigarette is not going to kill a patient with emphysema. Will kill a patient with heart disease.
How many will?
I don't think anybody knows that.
I don't know. That's not what the pulmonary people have told me.
Pulmonary people will not see a patient that smokes. They will discharge a patient.
That's a good way of dealing with the problem. Okay.
You can reverse the question, though, and you can say, of 100 lung cancers, how many of those people smoke?
Oh, yes. The vast majority of people affected by lung cancer have smoked. But that the reverse, the corollary is not true. It doesn't mean that the vast majority of smokers contract lung cancer.
This leads us to another related series of...
Louder.
This leads us to another related series of questions about risk-benefit ratios. Do we put in the same category of the Lord watches over... simple people or fools, a person who, for example, has to take a routine test,
mm-hmm.
let's say a CAT scan of the head, and it has a 1 in 40,000...
CAT scans are routine.
Let's say there is a... When I say routine, I mean for...
Non-invasive?
Would they call it non-invasive? But there is a quoted danger of... Well, a 1 in 40,000 risk of a fatality due to an unexpected allergy to the dye, to the injected material.
Mm-hmm.
Can we say that since the test is routinely used in this type of situation, the person should use this principle, or should we say this is not, that he's putting his life in danger by taking this test, assuming that that there's a question as to whether he must have the test to save his life. In other words, that it's not necessarily a black and white
Pekuach Nefesh situation. Let's separate the question. Deal first in cases where it's not Pekuach Nefesh, and then in cases where it is Pekuach Nefesh. And we don't have to look at things as so esoteric as allergy to the dye that's used in conjunction with a CAT scan. Why not talk about the danger of general anesthesia for elective surgery?
Okay.
People outside this room don't know the dangers of anesthesia. General anesthesia is dangerous, very dangerous. Yet people subject themselves to general anesthesia for cosmetic surgery, which may be also another ground. They subject themselves to general anesthesia for prostate problems that might conceivably be dealt with in some other way by catheterization or what have you. They will subject themselves to general anesthesia for other type, for a hernia repair. And for a hernia repair. In circumstances where... I'm giving you all the examples of elective surgery. Hernia repair, what?
You could do it under local.
It's not fair.
What's not fair?
Talk about hernia and cosmetic surgery.
Let me finish the sentence. Hernia repair in circumstances where there is only extremely remote likelihood of strangulation and the dangers associated with the hernia are far less significant than the dangers associated with general anesthesia. Is that qualifying you enough? If not, you make up some examples. But medicine, this happens all the time. People accept all kinds of things for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with pikuach nefesh. They do have a lot to do with elimination of pain and improving quality of life. Now, is it permissible or isn't it permissible? Now, here, again, let me begin by saying there are always two sides to the issue. There is a statement in the Mor Uktzi of Rav Yankov Emden. He says, he doesn't ask, he doesn't say it's forbidden, but he says, Kov be'enai leser. He said, it's almost forbidden in my eyes. Now, I don't know what almost forbidden, it seems to me that mutter and oster is like pregnancy. You can't be a little bit pregnant. Either you are or you're not. No, either it's mutter or it's not mutter. But what he meant to say was that his inclination is that it shouldn't be permissible, but he can't quite bring himself to say that it's... He was dealing specifically with a kidney stone or a gallbladder stone operations, which he viewed as being entirely elective in nature. Forget the medical realia. Whether they are elective or not elective is irrelevant. He was given the facts. His doctors told him that it was elective, and people do this only to eliminate pain because they want to have a pain-free environment, and that it's not a matter affecting either life or health. And yet, he said that if you come to ask him, should you do it or not, he'd say no. He wouldn't do it. Now, nobody, including Rav Yankov Emden, has ever given a blanket iser. And people do it all the time. They put it to if nobody is objective. It seems to me that you can justify this on one of two grounds. One ground is true today and was not true in the days of Rav Yankov Emden, namely, that general anesthesia then was A, more dangerous, B, perceived as being dangerous, whereas today, although it is a significant danger, what's the statistical risk? 1 in 2,000?
1 in 2,000.
Something like that.
What's the risk of general anesthesia?
1/10 of 1%.
Which is?
1 in 1,000.
1 in 1,000. I thought it was 1 in 2,000.
Okay, so that
I was told...
1/10 of 1%.
I thought, all right, what's the difference?
Mortality?
Mortality.
Mortality.
1/10 of 1%.
Yes. Right? 1 in 2,000. Okay, that's not insignificant by any means. Yet, outside of this room,
If you go, you know, walk on Atlantic Avenue and stop the first 10 people, ask them what are the statistics of dying of general anesthesia on the operating table if there's nothing else wrong with you, otherwise healthy patient, and they'll probably tell you 1 in a million. Try it sometime. The people out there don't know that it's dangerous. What does it mean? It means that it is a danger which society doesn't recognize as a danger. It's not a perceived danger. If it's not a perceived danger, then Shemer Psalm Hashem, or Ben Shalom, you know, he helps all these fools out there who don't know that things are risky. And you as a physician don't have an obligation to maximize the risk. You know, I think you should let the patient know there's a risk, particularly if it's entirely elective. I don't think you should let them know how bad the risk is if it's necessary, because if they don't have the operation, they've got a 99% chance of dying. But when you're dealing with somebody who wants cosmetic surgery, I think you should read the Riot Act in terms of general anesthesia. But the basic head there is Shemer P'soyim Hashem. That's the mat here. That's the reason it's permissible. In addition to that, it seems to me that there is a more fundamental reason that would permit all of these things, not cosmetic surgery, that's my hobby horse, but even procedures that are designed to eliminate pain as distinct from procedures that are necessary either for pikuach nefesh or restoration of health. And that is the basic matir, the source granting permission for all therapy. Verapa yirapa, says the Pasuk, person commits assault and battery, he's got to make amends, he has to pay the medical expenses of the victim, says the Gemara, Mikan Shnitna Rishus L'Roi Filarapais, from here there is a source justifying a physician practicing medicine. Now, clearly the Pasuk is not limited to cases of Pikuach Nefesh. You commit assault and battery, you have to pay the doctor's bills, even if it's only for a few stitches that are necessary only to prevent disfigurement. Even if there is no danger to life. And the doctor has a right to put in the stitches even if there is no danger to life. He also has a right to give an aspirin to alleviate pain, and the victim will recover the cost of the aspirin, whatever he paid in the local drugstore. That means that the physician has the right to dispense aspirins for headaches, even though aspirin is a dangerous drug. It's a highly dangerous drug. Says the Ramban, Ein lo chosam shemarape loze sheinemenis loze. If a medicine is any good at all, then it's dangerous. If it's not dangerous, it's not a good medicine. It works both ways. If it's strong enough to help one patient, says the Ramban, it can kill the next patient. How in the world is the doctor supposed to know whether it's going to kill this patient or not? The answer is he does not know. He relies on Shemer P'soyim Hashem or whatever. If this is the accepted therapy and it helps the vast majority of patients, we don't worry about the 1 in 40,000 who are allergic to the dye, or what's the incidence of penicillin allergy? There's higher, isn't it? 1 in 10,000 or something. You don't worry that the patient may die on the spot because you've given him a shot of penicillin, and you proceed to treat the infection by giving a penicillin injection. You're not obligated to be concerned, even if the situation that you are treating is not life-threatening in nature. So it means that these seem to be the two basic lines justifying elective surgery. A, Shemer P'soyim Hashem. B, there is a general blanket permission to engage in therapeutic measures, even for purposes of eliminating pain, even situations where there is no risk to life. Now, if we go back to the dye used for a CAT scan, and the question is, should it be done or shouldn't it be done? I think that here you've got to be somewhat prudent. If you are using a procedure because the patient may be suffering from something that affects one person in 50,000, and the danger of dying from the procedure is 1 in 40,000, I don't think you could justify doing the procedure. The procedure is more dangerous statistically than the situation you're trying to correct. If there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that the patient is suffering from a condition that you can diagnose and treat only this way, and if you don't diagnose it and you can't treat it, the patient's going to die, then you're certainly justified in taking a 1 in 40,000 chance in order to save the guy who has a 1 in 1,000 chance of being affected. As far as the patient is concerned, does the patient have the right to refuse this type of treatment? That becomes a much more significant question. Now, yesterday we did speak a little bit about the patient's right, or better, the fact that the patient does not have a right to refuse treatment. A patient doesn't have a right to refuse treatment, A, when his life is in danger, and B, when the medicine that he's being given isn't dangerous in nature. Now, if we're dealing with a patient who's got syphilis, Jews don't have syphilis. Give me something. clearly, let's take syphilis as an example. One way or another, he's contracted syphilis, and you leave syphilis untreated, it's fatal. And the best therapy these days, I understand, is still penicillin, but there is a chance that the patient may die immediately as a result of the penicillin shot rather than a couple of years down the road as a result of untreated syphilis. Does the patient have a right to refuse the penicillin injection under those circumstances? Come back to that in a second. Let's deal with a patient who's got severe cardiac problems, and the doctors have agreed that a coronary bypass is necessary, and that you cannot treat this medically, you've got to treat it surgically. And he is, given his condition, he is a 60 or 70% risk in terms of the procedure. 60 or 70% chance of dying on the table immediately. But the cardiologists have agreed that if you do not treat him, he has a 95% chance of dying within 6 months. If you do treat him and you're successful on the table, he'll survive normal lifespan. He'll live another 25 years or what have you. Does the patient have an obligation to submit to surgery under those circumstances? It seems to me that even if there's a 10% chance he'll die on the table, he has no obligation. That doesn't mean it's awesome. That's in the category of the permissible but not the mandatory. If he does not submit to surgery, he has a 95% chance of dying within 6 months, 8 months, or what have you. If he does submit to surgery, he has a 90% chance of a refuah shleima, whatever that means in terms of his physical condition and his age, but a 10% chance of dying sooner than he would have died otherwise. Now, that's a typical case in which you have a situation in which you are gambling what in halacha is called chayishah, this limited period of time which is available to him without therapy. You are literally gambling that limited period of time in order to buy a longer period of time. And that is perfectly permissible if there is a good, rational chance of success, even though the dangers may be significant. But by the same token, the patient has the right to refuse the procedure, and the doctor would have no right to force it upon him. The doctor shouldn't try to obfuscate. He shouldn't try to tell him that his chances are better than they are. If it's a 10% chance of mortality, the patient should know that. If it's 50%, he should certainly know how dangerous it is. That's in that case. But let's go back to the earlier case. We've got the patient who's going to die within, 5 years of syphilis, or whatever the period of time may be. But if he is one of the 10,000 who's allergic to penicillin, he's not going to walk out of the doctor's office. Does he have the right to refuse the penicillin injection? And here I think the answer is clearly no. It seems it's clearly no, because, let me phrase the question a little bit differently. What if you don't have the penicillin in your office, and you don't have a nurse or a technician around, and you tell the patient, look, I've got to give you the penicillin injection for syphilis, please take this prescription across the street to the pharmacy and fill it and come back and I'll give you the shot. And the patient protests and says, I'm not going to cross the street. It's dangerous to cross Atlantic Avenue. There's a 1 in 50,000 chance that I won't survive crossing the street corner. It's a dangerous business crossing the street. Now, that's ludicrous. I gave you what is a reductio ad absurdum. Why is it ludicrous? Because what right do I have to cross Atlantic Avenue in order to buy an ice cream cone, Cola di Sorrel, on the other side of the street, let alone crossing for purposes of of getting medicine in the drugstore? The reason I'm allowed to cross the street, people don't concern themselves with dangers of this nature. If I want to live and not be a neurotic, I will ignore the risks associated with crossing the street, as long as I cross on the red. I'm supposed to cross on the green. as long as I cross on the green. Okay, now, it seems to me then that when you have an act which is in the category of Shemer Psoim Hashem, the patient can't plead it's risky. and therefore I don't have to expose myself and risk my chayishah. I can't refuse to go across the street to the pharmacy to get the insulin, to get the penicillin. And it would seem to me that insofar as penicillin is concerned, the penicillin injection, absent a history in the family of penicillin allergy, that a penicillin injection is in the category of shemir kesodim Hashem. Therefore, the patient has an obligation to accept this minimal risk involved in the penicillin injection and doesn't have the right to say, I don't want it, it's dangerous. That type of danger is so remote and so small that it's clear it has to be assumed in order to eliminate the other risk, which is, in that situation, very significant and one that just can't be ignored. Now, the next step in this is that since the patient has to assume the risk, you can force the patient to assume the risk. You can force them in two ways. A, you don't have to tell them that taking penicillin injection is risky business. When the penicillin injection is necessary, as it is in the case of syphilis, I'm not sure that it's necessary in other cases, but in the case of syphilis, where it's clearly indicated you don't have to tell the patient. And B, as I said yesterday, in terms of halacha, you don't have to tell them what you're doing. Technically, you can simply inject it.
What is the difference between the two cases, the penicillin shot versus the surgery?
The difference is, as I perceive it, in the case of the penicillin injection, you're dealing with a statistical risk which is so remote, A, and B, which is not perceived as being a risk by society in general. Therefore, it's by definition not a risk. In other words, what I'm saying is that in terms of halacha, risk, sakona, whatever term is employed, has a definition. It's got a certain threshold level. The threshold may be statistical. The threshold may be psychological. It may be in the eye of the beholder. When you are dealing with something below that threshold, you're dealing with what is analogous to something which is subclinical. It's subhalachic. It doesn't count. If it doesn't count, then it's not there. In the case of the heart surgery, you're dealing with a danger that everybody recognizes as being a danger. Nobody dismisses the dangers of coronary bypass. The dangers of coronary bypass in a decent medical center today are under 5%. In a place like St. Luke's, it's something between 1 and 2%, they tell me. If you stop 10 people outside and ask them how risky is open heart surgery, coronary bypass, I suspect they're going to tell you that there's at least a 50% mortality rate. People out there think that coronary surgery is much more risky than it is, and the people out there think general anesthesia is much less risky than it is. And that all goes into this definition of Shemir Kesodim Hashem in terms of public perception.
Is there a certain percent that
again, it is not true that there are certain percents. Again, somebody said yesterday, I thought that the application was absolutely incorrect, but the principle is certainly correct. You can have two procedures, one more risky than the second, and the second permissible than the first also, because the second isn't perceived as a risk and the first is. I think the example that was given yesterday was totally incorrect, because I thought that the procedures involved were not perceived by people as being risky today. But halacha doesn't talk in terms of strict percentages. What you're dealing with here, in effect, is something a little bit different. You're dealing with what's basically a philosophical concept. You're saying, in effect, that the Ribbono Shel Olam created man, the Ribbono Shel Olam told man to live a normal life, and also told him not to engage in dangerous activity, because the Ribbono Shel Olam has other things to do besides saving people from danger. He doesn't want to have to intervene and to work miracles for people all the time. Therefore, there's the Yiddish expression that Malochim legnuta kishalach. Children at play are dangerous, and if they wouldn't be angels with cushions to put under them, they'd kill themselves every day of the week. But those Malochim have their job. Ribbono Shel Olam themselves sends them out to every playground with the cushions. That's part of his normal workload, and he assumes that obligation willingly. But he doesn't want to work overtime. He doesn't want to do things that aren't necessary. He's not about to perform the same services for Evel Knievel. What's the difference between the kid playing on the sandlot and Evel Knievel? The kid doesn't have the sense to protect himself. There's no way he can protect himself, even if he wants to. And Evel Knievel ought to find better things to do than to shoot the rapids in his barrel. And that depends upon how something is perceived. If it is perceived as being normal to everyday life, then by definition it's not a risk. You're not thumbing your nose at the Ribbono Shel Olam and saying, ha ha, I'm such a tzaddik, you're going to take care of me. and if you don't do that, then the Rebbeinu Shlomo will take care of you. But when you're engaging in daredevil style activity, you're in effect assuming risks that you have no business assuming, and everybody assumes risks on the presumption that it's going to be okay. In effect, he's saying, look, Rebbeinu Shlomo, I'm taking the risk, but you're going to bail me out. You have no right to do that.
Now,
it just depends upon the psychological state of mind of society in general.
But in terms of a physician's question here, we're dealing with tests or medications that the public has no idea about risk or not. They don't. They may not realize what a CAT scan is. They may. You may be giving them steroids, and they may not know that there are three pages of side effects in the PDR on this. Though, you can't really say the public perceives or doesn't perceive a risk.
Yeah.
Can you use the medical community's perception?
The medical community does not perceive steroids as placing the patients at risk. They've read the three pages in the PDR, and they kind of dismiss it. They you know, this happens, but to somebody else's patients, not to mine. And that's sure, it's happened to your patients.
No, I don't feel that way about using toxic medications. I mean,
you're practicing a different kind of medicine. You're using toxic medications for people who are going to die without the toxin.
No, I'm also using toxic medications for people that have curable diseases. And using toxic medications for people who don't have cancer, that need to be treated with all medications are toxic. But physicians have the obligation to not dismiss the three pages, but know them, know the side effects, watch out for the side effects.
Of course, you watch the side effects.
And protect patients.
Yeah, but you're being overly cerebral. In general, in effect, what you do is dismiss the three pages when you prescribe for the patient. You'll be aware enough to look for the side effects, of course. But when you prescribe it for the patient, in effect, what you've decided that you don't have to be concerned with side effects because those are so remote that they don't have to be considered in a serious way. Well, that's obviously what you're doing. In effect, what you are going to do is to say to yourself, what are the statistical risks involved to this patient? And you're going to make the decision on that basis, are you not? I mean, if you practice conservative medicine, that's what you do. If you practice happy-go-lucky medicine, then even if the risks are significant, you simply tell the patient how risky it is and prescribe anyway. But no responsible physician does that. If you know that there is a therapy for a given illness, but you assume that the risks are too great, you're not even going to tell the patient that there's an option. I'll give you an example, okay? 5 years ago, when modified radical mastectomies were first introduced, a surgeon could have reacted in one of two ways. He could have reacted by telling every patient that came in, look, I know that a radical has a very good chance of curing you. I don't know what a modified is going to do. It's still too early to tell. Do you want to take the risk? That's how some physicians might react. Other physicians would react by saying, look, I know that a radical is going to do the job, or at least it's the best therapy available. I have absolutely no idea whether a modified radical will do the job as well or not. Therefore, I'm not even going to tell the patient. I won't put the patient in that quandary. Those are two ways of practicing medicine. If you'll ask me how should a Jewish physician practice medicine, the first way, not the second way. You don't give the patient the option of a therapy which is too dangerous for a prudent person to assume. You simply don't give the patient that risk because if the patient were to come ask the Shaila, there's no question in my mind what I would have to tell the patient. If the patient would come 5 years ago, forget about it, now I'd have to go back and ask somebody to send me the latest articles. I don't know what's in the literature today. Certainly 2 years ago, let alone 2 months ago, 2 years ago I would have had to say it's absolutely ulcer to perform a radical, a modified radical in place of a radical. Because this is a sachel sheyesh b'sakana, the dangers of surgery are one and the same whichever procedure you use. The benefit is entirely cosmetic. You have no right to assume that risk to life.
Now we know the modified radical is usually just as good.
That's what they tell me. I'm not sure. Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Be sure.
We have two experts here.
Good statistics saying it's just as good. They're equally good. Okay. If you are convinced that there are good studies. All right. If you are convinced that there are good studies indicating that a modified radical is just as good today, then fine, by all means. Why in the world should you do a radical if you can do a modified radical? You shouldn't, if you're convinced. If you're convinced. If you're not convinced, it's quite different.
That isn't even a reasonable question, because...
Really? It's not a reasonable question?
The question was asked. Beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, 5 or 10 years ago, not.
No, of course, of course. Of course.
Now, there's no question.
You seem to be implying that you could assume a risk, for, let's say, for pain, and yet here... In other words, is there an absolute contraindication? Let's say a medicine has a very minimal but definite risk of fatality, agranulocytosis in very rare cases. You're giving it to relieve severe pain, the trigeminal neuralgia treated with Tegretol, let's say. Can you do that?
And the risk to the patient is remote, and the medical community would regard that as being an acceptable kind of treatment. The Schirmer's plate.
Right, but there is a risk of a fatality,
sure.
Even though you're not treating
right.
A fatal disease.
Because this patient is not at risk here and now. You're afraid that you may place him at risk by giving him the medicine, and that's a remote danger, therefore you can assume that risk.
We have Mrs. Schoenberg.
With the advent of the toxic shock syndrome, as far as getting that, that's also a residual possibility.
Right. Let's put it this way. I'm assuming for purposes of this question that there is such a thing as a toxic shock syndrome that has as its cause the use of certain tampons. During the period of time when that was in the headlines and on the television set, etc., during that period of time, I don't think there was a Schirmer psoriasis machine. I think at that point, people were very conscious of the danger. During that period, I think it would have been also to use it. I'm assuming that there is... Remember, if people think that X, Y, or Z is dangerous, there are some people who think that it's dangerous to walk out in the street in 50-degree weather without a jacket or a coat. Every doctor knows that's nonsense. That doesn't mean that it's dangerous and you have no right to walk outside without a jacket or a coat. It's problemizes or whatever, the equivalent. There's no basis in fact. But when there is a basis in fact and the danger is perceived as being real, then it's not in the category of Schirmer psoriasis at any point. I mean, when you're dealing with a situation involving a callback, for example, government callback, that I think did occur with the tampons, did it not? Yeah, one brand of tampons.
All the brands have a warning.
Right. When we're dealing, they've got a warning, but they're on the shelves, and people are using them. We may have seen a transition. During the early weeks, a kind of generalized fear, in which case there was no Schirmer psoriasis machine, and now you're back with the Surgeon General's warning us on cigarette packages, and you've got a situation Schirmer psoriasis machine again. People are oblivious to whatever danger may be involved. So again, this is something which is subject to change. It depends upon societal perception. How do people out there view this activity? Do they view it as being particularly risky, or do they view it as being innocuous, with minimal risk? When they view it as being risky, when you have people panicking over it, then obviously it's also, provided that there is an element of risk involved.
Well, the panic now has died down.
Sure.
So
I think you're back at a kind of Schirmer psoriasis situation.
Dr. Free?
So do you have a right to use?
Yes. Certainly.
What is the form that the protection takes? In other words, we know that there are things then that are very dangerous, general anesthesia, cigarette
mm-hmm.
smoking, that the general public feels is not.
Mm-hmm.
What's the form of the protection? Obviously, there are people who are getting very sick from it or dying.
Oh, yes, yes.
How is that seen as protection?
Schirmer psoriasis machine is not a guarantee that eventually and will protect everybody. It means you have a right to rely upon his good judgment with regard to whether to protect you or not. Nothing more than that. It's not a guarantee that nothing untoward is going to happen. There are no such guarantees in life.
Yes, Mrs.
Burke. What about weighing the risk between a home birth and going to a hospital where nowadays you have almost a 50% chance of having a C-section because of the... Because of the lack of interest in the doctors.
Rebitz and Berkowitz, let us not malign the medical profession. Doctors like to use their tools. Doctors and grave diggers hate to use their tools, I should hope.
But not my doctor. That's
sorry.
Look, there. Let me try to rephrase the question for you. I'll try to remove the hysteria from the question. A woman. A woman who has no medical need for a C-section and has a decent doctor is not going to have a C-section. That's not true. I said a woman who has a competent doctor. Not where?
Not in Kaiser Hospital.
I know nothing about Kaiser Hospital. I don't know if it's...
When Rabbi Black referred to Kaiser as General Motors yesterday, he was talking about the prophets, not the...
I would suggest then that she find another medical facility.
No, but what about... Is there child and having it at home? Means there are some risks.
Sure. There's no question that there are certain risks associated with hospital stays. Those are statistically demonstrable. There are infections that roam the corridors of hospitals and don't find them elsewhere. However, I'm not a gynecologist yet. It would seem to me that the risks of home delivery are far, far greater than any possible risk in a decent medical facility with a competent physician. A normal childbirth needs a doctor about as much as the woman needs a hole in the head. You don't need a doctor for a normal childbirth. You do need a doctor, and you need him very badly in cases of complication. Now, obstetrics is about the one crucial area in medicine where you don't have time for a second opinion. In most cases in medicine, hours aren't going to make the difference, the crucial difference. Ignoring what I said last night about not delaying on Shabbos when the patient's life is in danger, you don't delay, but you do know that if you have to delay, chances are very good that you're not going to kill the patient by delaying. The one significant exception is childbirth. You cannot delay in childbirth when there is a problem that's got to be taken care of immediately, and it's a problem that a midwife cannot handle. You need a good obstetrician only if there's a problem. If you don't have a problem, you don't need an obstetrician altogether. So what difference does it make whether he's good or not good? I think that it's highly dangerous to have babies at home. I wouldn't advocate it. If you're going to ask me whether it's mutter or ulcer to have, is it ulcer to have a baby at home? I can't tell you that it's ulcer to have a baby at home, but I think that anybody who chooses to have a baby at home is a fool. A real one. I think we ought to recite a few kapitlach tilim asking him to watch over any such fools. But before the tilim, I would want to warn the woman that she's being very foolish. It's not the wise thing to do by any means.
Rana.
I would like to change the subject only because I would like to hear your answer to this question. Two part. One, do I understand correctly that there is no situation where a physician can write a no-code order?
We're going to be getting to these questions. I don't mean to interrupt, but we're trying to keep it in a certain order, and we have a whole series of questions about that and about resuscitation.
So far, question number one.
So far,
what? Question number two, then.
If it's more, yeah.
Only on the question asked. Only on the original question, only in the category of the question asked. That was important.
In other words, on risk, do you have a question on risk-benefit ratios of some kind? Or?
No.
I'll tell you.
The chairman rules you out of order. I'm sorry.
No, I don't need to do that. Let me do this. Can we first finish this topic, then we'll start that topic, and maybe if the rabbis will decide whether we have to dire Meirev at this point or if we can wait, I don't know, since we normally have it at this point. Does anybody have any further question on this topic, and then we'll have Breiner start the next topic.
By the same token, a good midwife can recognize a complication, there would be plenty of time.
That's not what my obstetricians tell me. No. Look, my dermatologists agree. And
I suspect that it's not Gimli. No, they've done. Then I don't suspect them of agreeing because they are they're shuttling patients back and forth between themselves. I think they know what they're talking about.
Yes, Dr. Wolf.
I think there's a very important implication in the original question that you asked, which we glossed over, which is in the phrase "routine CAT scan," because I think there's an implication in that question, which we really should address in terms of halakha. A CAT scan, at least 50% of the time, is ordered in situations where it's not medically indicated, but it's ordered for medical legal reasons. And I think that's probably part of the implication of that phrase, routine CAT scan. So I think that this raises the whole issue.
Yeah.
If somebody comes
into
the room with a banged head,
right.
and you order a CAT scan which has 1 to 40,000 chance of killing them,
I absolutely don't agree that you have a right to do a CAT scan because you've got to pay the bill for the machine. And the only way to pay the bill is to...
Wait
a minute, that's number one. We're taking the simple ones. that absolutely should not be done.
Right.
There are cases in which doctors practice preventive malpractice medicine. They're doing all kinds of tests, which they do not believe are necessary, but they've got to have a record on which they can defend themselves if they are exposed to malpractice suits. Now, my understanding is that in most cases, when a doctor does something of that nature, there is probably a cogent medical reason for doing it, but there may be an equally cogent reason for not doing it. Under those circumstances, I think that you have an obligation to tell a patient. In other words, I don't think that in the case indicated you talked about before, what you called a routine CAT scan, where there is a medical reason for the CAT scan, but it's certainly not absolutely imperative to be done, it's not mandatory, and there is a certain element of risk. I think under those circumstances, you have an obligation to tell the patient there is an element of risk. By the same token, if it's true, to tell the patient there is a medical reason for doing this. I'm not sure the reason is imperative. I'm not sure that it's worth the trade-off. You make the decision. I think that would be the prudent way of responding. I don't think that you have a right to do a procedure only for purposes of building a record for a defense in a possible malpractice action when there is even a remote danger to the patient.
This was part of the implication of your question?
No, the fact that it was routine simply meant there was no specific... extremely life-threatening situation.
Routine means many things in many cases.
Right.
For example, if you do a physical exam, you're going to take a chest X-ray as a matter of routine. That's good medicine. Every time a patient is admitted to a hospital, they do a chest X-ray. I had the experience a couple of years ago of being admitted to the hospital, not anything terribly serious, but being admitted to the hospital twice within a period of 2 weeks, and each time they wanted to give me a chest X-ray. The first time I accepted the chest X-ray, the second time I declined the chest X-ray, and I suddenly felt somebody is twisting my arm. I was getting an argument. I was told this is routine. It's done every time you're admitted to a hospital. And I said, what kind of business is this? I know it's done routinely. I also know that there are risks associated with this procedure. I know the benefits of the procedure. I know that I've had all the benefits 2 weeks ago, and there are no further benefits to accrue today. And I also am aware of my rights, and I refuse to submit to the chest X-ray and then therapy. That was also routine. Now, the point I'm making is the word routine has different meanings in different contexts. When it's good routine medicine or it's routinely good medicine, fine. When it's routine but it's not routinely good medicine, then there's no reason to do something simply because it's a matter of routine. You know, because the sheet says that this is what the intern is supposed to request doesn't mean that he's not supposed to use his head once in a while.
It's Rabbi Greenhill.
So the prayer in general, the doctor told him that he wants to take his hand.
Yeah, a son.
He's allowed to take.
Are there any
but
risks?
The question is because the doctor, by taking the sonogram, you will not. So he will know just about it, but he will not. He will not be able to do anything.
What do you mean he won't be able to do anything? Hey, the sonogram. Well, first of all, let's start from the beginning. I'm not aware of any dangers associated with a sonogram. Am I right or wrong? Is there any danger in the sonogram?
There's just starting to be some suspicion that there might be.
What's the danger?
Up until recently. Sure.
Danger of what?
Danger of what? What's
the...
What's the danger to
the
radiation? Sonogram doesn't involve radiation.
Real time in the area.
It's not ionizing radiation.
Real time.
Real time sonograms.
The doctors disagree with my. My information was that
the doctor won't be able to develop.
Okay, all right.
The doctor won't be able to do anything about it.
What do you mean won't be able to do anything about it? You do a hold. As an obstetrician or a gynecologist in the room, you do a sonogram in order to determine A, fetal location, B, fetal size, and of course C, fetal abnormalities such as hydrocephalus. If you know that the baby has a head that's too large for the pelvis, you're darn well you're going to do something about it. That's called a C-section, the kind of thing that Reverend Berkowitz is worried about. But this is... But in this case, it's one...
So you will know just a week before that he has to make a C-section?
Of course, they won't let the woman go into labor.
He's saying as a routine, I guess. You're talking about a routine sonogram that, in other words, there's no nobody perceives it any problem, but he's just going to do it as a routine basis.
Of course, he's talking about a routine sonogram. But the routine sonogram, assuming that it is in itself innocuous, will disclose certain problems that the doctor may not discover any other way. And if so, why not? The only reason not to is if there is a danger associated with the procedure. At that point, you've got to weigh the risk-benefit and decide.
Yeah, let's say there was a case that the doctor said that the baby is too high, especially she was in this month, and they said that the baby is too high.
Right.
So he wants to take a sonogram. So he will know something. But he's not going to be able to do right now anything about it.
Okay, the question... The question really is...
A good doctor is not consumed by idle curiosity. When he wants facts, he wants them for a reason. And he doesn't want them simply to be able to throw up his hands and say, I can't do anything about it. When the doctor wants to know about an abnormality, it's because, Baruch Hashem, there are many abnormalities which are amenable to treatment of one kind or another. He's got to find out about an enlarged head in order to be able to treat it at the proper time. He doesn't want the woman to go into labor first and then to be confronted with a woman in advanced labor and have to do a C-section, which is terribly dangerous, if he can do it before when there's a minimal risk involved.
I think I can rephrase the question a bit and put into focus. Is there... Would there be anything wrong with doing a non-invasive, totally innocuous test simply to obtain baseline information when you don't suspect any problem, but which might show you something? In other words, when your treatment probably will not change as a result of the
test. Even though there's only a remote chance it'll be a felt.
Right. You don't expect it to change
your
treatment, but it might show something.
You're doing a non-invasive, innocuous procedure because maybe there will be some benefit. No reason why not to. There may not be any terribly pressing medical reason to do it, but it's certainly not us, by any stretch of the imagination.
Binyam.
Can you find Hashem? Can you find it to a woman deciding not to visit, a pregnant woman deciding not to see a gynecologist during pregnancy?
I don't think so. I think that most people know that pregnancy is dangerous, it's highly dangerous, and they're aware of the fact that you need regular medical examinations during pregnancy, and I don't think a woman has a right to forego such examinations.
Could we ask a question on that's been circulating around the community, at least from my point of view? That is, I'll read the question as it's written. If a definite risk of blindness or paralysis is known to occur after hot baths in susceptible individuals, such as those with multiple sclerosis, should the community mikveh be kept below this temperature lest someone go in before she knows she has this disease?
I read the question and I was terribly puzzled. I'm puzzled. Let me explain why I'm puzzled. I presume that these women take hot baths at home.
Which women?
the women who are unaware of the fact that they have multiple sclerosis and are unaware of the fact that hotbeds are dangerous to multiple sclerosis.
No, let's say they do.
Therefore, I don't know what added danger is involved in using a heated mikveh.
No.
And whatever damage has been done long ago at home anyway.
No.
That was just my problem.
We must assume they don't take hotbeds or they would have precipitated the attack before.
We assume that...
That's what I'm talking about, people who, in other words, a woman never took a hotbed, or a man, makes it much easier
for me to answer the question.
Okay.
What you're asking is, do we as a community have to be concerned less there are people who don't bathe, people who don't bathe, who may be victims of multiple sclerosis, see people who don't bathe, who are victims of multiple sclerosis, and are not yet aware of the fact, and D, people who don't bathe may be victims, are not aware of the fact, and this hot bath may do them damage.
Not that they don't bathe, they don't take...
They don't take hot baths.
No, hot means above, very hot, above body temperature.
Of course.
That's what we're talking
about. That's what a hot bath is.
Above, right.
You know, it's not above body temperature, it's not hot.
People can bathe in temperature.
Yeah, I understand. You know, but I think most people, if they bathe in water, which is above body temperature.
Nice.
Now, in effect, what you're telling me is, you're asking is, do we have to be cheshish for, do we have to be concerned lest this phenomenon exists someplace out there, as something which is so infinitesimally remote that I don't think it's even a miyuta de miyuta. I don't think that you have to be concerned about something of that nature. Now, of course, people who might have multiple sclerosis shouldn't take hot baths and shouldn't go into hot mikvahs, etc., etc. But I think that the danger of all of this is so terribly remote that nobody has to be concerned about it. Not the woman going to the mikveh or the man going to the hot bath, nor the community providing the hot baths.
You're talking about because of the percentages and all.
Of course, of course.
That's the director of hygiene of the mikveh.
I don't think that, I don't think that one need be concerned with it. You know, it's like crossing the street. Crossing the street is statistically much more dangerous than going to a hot mission. Have I opened the Pandora's box?
I closed it.
But I don't think the mikveh should be hot on Shabbos.
Now you've opened it again. Can I ask for an opinion of the Rabbeim? Are we supposed to break for Marav, or can we continue or what? We went a little over, but usually the Minyan Kavod is about a quarter to nine.
I suggest we have Marav, a 5-minute break, and sit down again.
They're more or less finished with the written questions.
Well, the ladies are also invited to Daven Meir, if I hope.
Well, we have some cakes
behind
the ladies for everybody, actually.
The ladies can wait for this break to be cool now, or maybe they prepare to do the ladies.
Oh, that's it.
One more topic?
Okay,
Bryna, do you want to open the next...
First of all, is there any case where a physician can order a no-code? And then the second part is, if, you know, I'm a critical care nurse in a situation where a physician has ordered a no-code, well, obviously, am I obligated to go ahead and resuscitate the woman?
Can't you think of an easier question?
I have heard I should come up with this stuff. Pass it.
Okay.
Don't
pass the buck. Fine.
The buck stops here.
Yeah. You probably warned them. I was coming. All right. Look. One of the first rules is never say never. I will not say that you can never order a no code. However, the situation no code. Well, let our nurse explain the term.
When a physician writes a no code order, it means that if when the time the heart stops, when the time breathing stops.
Let me explain for everybody. Every hospital has a code, they call it. When a patient goes into cardiac arrest, means his heart stops.